You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, a brand new addition to the Monocle 24 lineup coming to you live from Midori House and from just down the road from us at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Robert Bounds. On today's show, Edward Lucas and Raffaello Pantucci ask if Vladimir Putin has become the Machiavelli of international diplomacy. Then, as the scramble for resources and trade routes spikes, we ask if Russia and China are headed for confrontation in Central Asia or the Arctic.
It's not only China, it's important for Europe. I mean, if you think about the whole dynamism between Asia and Europe, there is an alternative to the Suez-Indian Ocean route coming up there. We all have to look at it very, very carefully, very seriously.
More from the Finnish ambassador to the Arctic a little bit later on. We'll also take a stroll around Istanbul's first organic food market.
This marketplace project is a model. This is the first in Turkey. This marketplace, organic marketplace project is national.
And as with every day here on Aperitivo, we'll stop by the Monocle Cafe for a coffee and a chat. Today, as Fashion Week here in London winds down, we'll chat with the head of the Somerset House Trust. All that, plus new music and a look ahead to the rest of today's shows with Tom Lewis and Marcus Hippie. That's Aperitivo. I'm Robert Bounds. It's happening right now on Monocle 24. It's a lot to squeeze in an hour on this, our second edition of Aperitivo. First, of course, at the top of the hour, it's news time with Paul Osborne.
North Korea has been accused of unspeakable atrocities in a UN report. Investigators say they've uncovered widespread abuses of human rights. They spoke to former prisoners and people who'd been exiled by the regime, though they were not allowed inside the country. Kim Jong-ho from North Korea's mission in Geneva dismisses the allegations.
My delegation totally rejects the oral update by the so-called Commission of Inquiry on the human rights situation in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The oral update is another copy of faked materials on the situation of human rights in my country.
Russia's foreign minister says he is still not convinced the Syrian regime was behind last month's chemical attack in Damascus. Sergei Lavrov was speaking after talks with his French counterpart, Laurent Fabius, in Moscow. Mr. Fabius said the publication of a UN report which highlighted the use of sarin gas left no doubt that President Assad's forces were responsible for the attack, in which it's thought hundreds of people were killed. One of the main spokesmen for the Muslim Brotherhood has been arrested by police in Egypt. Gehad al-Haddad was reportedly detained in Cairo. He's been a regular interviewee on English-language television and radio around the world since the army moved to depose the president, Mohamed Morsi, in July. The Supreme Court in Bangladesh has sentenced an Islamist leader to death for crimes dating back more than 40 years. Abdul Qadir Mullah was jailed for life earlier this year over violence in the 1971 War of Independence with Pakistan. But that sentence led to street protests, with demonstrators insisting he should be executed. And today, the country's highest court agreed. It's not clear when he'll be executed, but Sahidul Islam, who fought in the war, says there should be no delay.
I am very happy from my heart and soul. Justice done. Nation happy. I am happy. Now I am waiting when Qadir Mullah will be hanged. As soon as possible. Qadir Mullah have to be hanged.
An armed standoff continues in a ski resort in Austria after three police officers and an emergency worker were shot dead. It happened near the town of Annaberg when officers tried to arrest a suspected poacher. He has now barricaded himself in a farmhouse. Police say he's heavily armed and refusing to speak to authorities. The operation to raise the Costa Concordia cruise ship has ended successfully. The operation continued through the night. It eventually took 19 hours to roll the ship onto a platform. 32 people died when the ship capsized in January last year off the Italian coast. Nicholas Sloan was in charge of the salvage operation.
We called on the radio between all the vessels and we said that 0400 hours across the Concordia is upright and safely resting on the grout mattress and platforms. You could hear the guys were really chuffed all over, you know, they were blowing their horns, jumping up and down.
Sufferers of coulrophobia should avoid the English town of Northampton after the sudden and unexplained appearance of a clown. He appears to be modelled on a sinister clown in a Stephen King novel, and so far has offered to paint a woman's windowsills, even though he had no brush or paint. He's been spotted late at night in several locations across the town since his first appearance last Friday. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. Chlorophobia. Did you hear me scribbling it down while you were doing your news headlines? I hope it wasn't too loud in your ear.
A furtive scribbling.
It was a furtive scribbling, but I'm a pencil user. I didn't want it to be sort of too loud. But was that a new word? Is it always nice to add a new word to the newscast?
The lexicon of news.
The lexicon of news
has grown. But actually, I was researching because I thought I'm sure there is a word for the fear of clowns. So yeah. I did my research, and it turns out it is basically there was no word for the fear of clowns until someone a few years ago online said, "Isn't there a word for the fear of clowns?" And it was just invented.
I think it's a fear that practically half the population at least must suffer from, right?
Yeah,
and that's why Stephen King wrote his book about a sort of.
And this guy is supremely modelled on the spooky clown from the Stephen King novel, and he hangs around late at night, knocking on people's doors, saying, "Would you like your windowsills painted?"
It's a very specific request.
It's probably
and one
promoting
that sounds very
something.
Euphemistic.
It's probably promoting something really odd. In a week's time, we'll discover that there's a bar themed on clowns opening there or something.
Exactly.
And we've all been taken in.
We've all been taken in. Get thee to Northampton. Paul Osborne, we'll hear from you at the bottom of the hour. Thank you very much. You're tuned in to Aperitivo. We're coming to you live from Studio One at London, 1806 here in London. We'll be back in a sec.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo. The time is, what is it? It's 2:07 a.m. in Tokyo. It's 18:07 here in London, making it just shy of lunchtime in New York City. It's time now for us to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. Joining me now with their take on the news is Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist, and Raffaello Pantucci, senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. That was quite a long introduction. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Welcome to the end of the day. You can hear some aperitivo possibly going into glasses there. You've got to serve yourself, actually. It's a sort of serve yourself studio here. We're going to talk Syria today as the diplomacy over the crisis continues. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, speaking at a news conference in Moscow today with France's top diplomat, insisted that a new UN resolution on Syria not allow the use of force. Yet he suggested that if Bashar al-Assad violates his government's agreement to abandon its chemical weapons supply, then the issue should be reconsidered. First, let's hear the statement from Lavrov.
Доклад доказывает, как можно судить по ознакомлению с ним.
The UN inspector's report proves, as we can judge from reading it at yesterday's plenary session, that the chemical weapons were indeed used. The questions we immediately had as our instant reaction, we asked them at the UN Security Council. There is no answer as to where the weapon was produced, whether it was on an official factory or it was homemade. There are also no answers to a number of other questions we posed. We want the events of the 21st of August to be impartially, objectively, professionally investigated. We have serious grounds to believe that it was a provocation.
And that was Russia's Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov speaking today in Moscow with the French Foreign Minister. I'm joined in the studio by Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist, and Raffaello Pantucci, senior research fellow of the Royal United Services Institute. I thought I'd reintroduce you.
You can use
there.
Our acronym as well, RUSI.
RUSI.
Makes it easier.
I just like saying the whole thing.
It's nice, punchy.
I'm kind of practicing it live, you know.
Absolutely.
Gentlemen, it's been strange watching this unfold on the TV, this story, what is still the Syrian crisis over the last. Well, certainly today, it's simply a lot of newscasts. There's simply a lot of press conferences, men in suits in Moscow. arguing. We've kind of lost a lot of, maybe we've lost a bit of track of what's going on in Syria itself. Is this kind of just the way the news cycle unfolds? Are you kind of wishing that we could get back to where we started with this?
I think it's not quite the news cycle, but the spin cycle with Russia running the machine. And what we've seen is attention being diverted from what is the humanitarian catastrophe of the 21st century and the use of chemical weapons against civilian population, which is a war crime. And instead, we're getting bogged down in diplomatic process, which I think is exactly what Russia wants. Russia has whitewashed its deplorable record over the last couple of years in the Syrian crisis, where it was consistently playing the role of spoiler, vetoing any attempt to put pressure on the Assad regime, and is now casting itself, bizarrely, as a peacemaker and getting a place at the top table. This not really because of Russia's strength, but because of the West's astonishing weakness and the appalling behaviour of President Barack Obama in particular.
And is this, Raf, is this sort of a masterstroke of diplomacy on Russia's part? Edward was saying it's more down to the West's weakness than Russia's skill, perhaps. But it takes something to, as Edward says, to recast yourself as a peacemaker, at least in the eyes of quite a lot of people, either the Russian population, maybe even the Chinese.
Well, I mean, I think that the, Edward's right in that, you know, Russia has been able to show a consistent line. And so, and because the West has not really had this same thing, even within Western countries, you've got divided populations about whether we should do something or whether we shouldn't. Look at the United Kingdom. There was the vote in the House of Parliament, which was quite close, but showed really that there was no clear sense of what we should be doing there. Even if you read the newspapers, there is a lot of sort of public outrage about what's happening in Syria, but there's not that sense of, well, what do we need to do about this? Whereas from Russia, you get a very clear, consistent line that says, we don't become involved in this, we protect the Assad regime, they're not responsible for this, and, you know, we don't support the rebels. So they get a very hard line, whereas here you get a much more mixed message, and that, I think that helps, you know, me, it results in the news cycle, which seems to be very dominated by Russia. I think the other element is, I think the Russians have obviously identified some pretty good PR people. And I think they've identified some good, you know, representatives. The op-ed which ran, was it at the weekend in the New York Times or the Herald Tribune, that Putin, I'm sure, didn't pen himself, even though I saw some reports that he had.
It was written by the Ketchum PR company, which very ably represents Russia in the United States.
It's, yeah, but and this ran with Putin's photo byline next to it, perhaps?
Yes. Well, it was with his, you know, byline, so it was coming out of him. And it was a very nuanced and very sort of well-written and well-crafted piece. And I think a lot of people sort of stopped and looked and said, oh, maybe the Russian line isn't so irrational or sort of anti-Western after all. Whereas I think it does mask the sort of very basic reality which we're all seemingly willing to move beyond, which is the fact that the civil war still goes on. More than 100,000 people have died. Someone, be it the regime, probably the regime, has used chemical weapons against their own people. And the West is still debating about what we should be doing about this.
We are inevitably talking about, as Edward called it, the spin cycle. What have the tactics been, Edward, and how transparent do you think Russia's tactics have been in this?
I think Russia's identified very well the divisions within the West and also in Western countries. They've seen that the European Union isn't really able to get to grips with this, that the opinion within the European Union is divided, with France wanting to do something quite muscular, perhaps bolstered by the success of their operation in Mali. Britain, with the Prime Minister, who's suddenly become quite keen to do things, but then has been tripped up by his own parliament. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, very keen not to get involved in another war in the Middle East, although America is the one country with the military power to make a difference. And this kind of weakness, this division, makes it very easy for the Russians to start exploiting the situation. I think it's worth remembering they have an interest in instability in the Middle East because that keeps the oil price up. And at the moment, both the gas and the oil price seem to be heading downwards, which is very bad for Russia. So they need anything to keep that propped up because it means more money for the regime. And they also like to be able to pretend to be a superpower, which they have only really in form of nuclear weapons and their veto at the UN Security Council. But for Putin's own domestic agenda, he needs to show that he's a guy who matters, Russia's a country who matters, and also that regime change is not going to happen in Syria or indeed in Russia. He's very worried that once we get into the habit of toppling authoritarian dictators, that train might end up pulling into a station in Moscow.
Well, I don't want to get completely off. I don't want to take this train in a completely other direction, but it would be nice. I think Ralph's got a point. But maybe we'll come back to the idea of how this defines what a superpower is. Even if you can chuck a superpower-sized spanner in the works, maybe that defines you as one. Ralph, what were you going to take up from Ed?
Well, I mean, the thing I was going to say was, with regards to your last point, the one about Ed's last point about how there's a sort of a line that maybe can be seen here from Moscow of, you know, regime change in Syria, meaning regime change in Moscow, possibly. I mean, that's something I've heard in Beijing repeatedly. You know, in Beijing, there was this definite sense of it's Syria, then it's Iran, then it's us, maybe, you know, and there's this sense of great fear and this sense of impending doom. But it's never totally clear to me how much actually that concern really resonates, or is that just used as some sort of cover for a greater desire to be seen as a player on the world stage? I think China's role within this whole, within the whole Syria conversation and, well, I guess the international debacle at the moment, has been very taking a back seat. They sort of have been letting the Russians be the ones who go up front and sort of cause the big noise. Lavrov's the man who's sort of shouting about it. Putin's writing the op-eds. And China just sort of coasts along behind. You know, I mean, it implicitly supports everything that Russians do, but doesn't really need to stick its neck out.
And I think if Russia had been brought on side, as it was, for example, during the Yugoslav crisis, when Russia played a big role in getting Milosevic to end the Yugoslav war back in the 90s, then I don't think China would be vetoing that. I think China's, in a way, able to just sit back and it will veto or abstain as it needs to. But I think the guilt for the blood of all these hundreds of thousands of people who've been either killed or injured or made homeless as a result of the war does rest in the Kremlin. It's astonishing to me that the Russia has got the kind of chutzpah to portray itself as a peacemaker. It's like some sort of little boy who murders his parents with an axe and then tells the court to take mercy on him because he's an orphan. It's even more amazing that the world will take it seriously.
I wanted to take us kind of back to the beginning. We described in our introduction, or we wondered in our introduction, if Putin was the modern Machiavelli of global politics. That analogy is never a kind one. You said that Barack Obama had behaved pretty badly in this, Edward. Flesh that out? It's an interesting thing when so many people seem so well disposed to Obama and America's position on this.
I'm not sure many people do feel so well disposed. I mean, he came in as at the beginning of his first term with colossal moral and political capital. I mean, if he told the people of Europe they had to dye their hair blue and dance in circles, they'd have done it out of sheer joy and friendship. And I think he's now turning into the worst foreign policy president, possibly the worst president since Jimmy Carter, possibly even worse than Jimmy Carter. And I think the way to look at it is that although Bush made terrible mistakes, and you know, the Iraq war being perhaps most prominent among them, he was basically trying to do the right thing. He did it very incompetently and unsuccessfully, but he had the basic idea that America's job was to try and lead the free world. Sounds a bit corny, but I think it's true. And Obama is not just misusing those tools, he's throwing the tools away. He's retreating from American leadership. He's snubbing his allies, appeasing enemies. And I think really heralding a new era of American isolationism. And that's really scary. If people say we didn't like a world where, you know, unipolar world where America was in charge, but I think we're going to like a multipolar world even less.
This one could run and run, at least our discussion of it as well. Ralph, I know you have a point to make. We're going to take a little bit of a short break. You're tuned in at 1818 here in London to Aperitivo. It's Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bound. I'm joined with Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist, and Raffaello Pantucci, senior research fellow at RUSI. Let's use the acronym. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll ask if the struggle for resources and trade routes will lead Russia and China into conflict. Stay tuned.
The Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all, and on it lives.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favorite critics, opinion makers, and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
And that was a jaunty promotional vehicle for the review show on Saturday. You are tuned in right now to Aperitivo. It's a new show here on Monocle 24. The personnel are Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist, and Raffaello Pantucci, senior research fellow at RUSI. Now, let's move from Russia's diplomacy over Syria to its backyard, Central Asia and the Arctic. In a bit, we'll talk about Russia and China's power struggle in Central Asia. But for the moment, and briefly, let's talk about the Arctic, where Putin announced yesterday he's reopening an old Soviet-era military base. It's all part of a drive to make Russia's northern coast a global shipping route. So what does Putin really want there? And does China have a dog in this fight too? A little earlier, we heard from Finland's ambassador to the Arctic.
China has been very active on Arctic research, has been very open on their need for energy particularly. And in that sense, has been very interested to the opening transport routes. I think it's also, it's not only China, it's important for Europe. I mean, if you think about the whole dynamism between Asia and Europe, there is an alternative to the Suez-Indian Ocean route coming up there. And we all have to look at it very, very carefully, very, very seriously. So China is approaching from research, is discussing very actively about the environmental issues. If you take the climate change, the Chinese officials have been quite open to say that they are to be blamed to a large extent to the climate change, but also that they are suffering from the effects of the climate change. So through this environmental participation, being a player there, they are also establishing their place in the discussions of the Arctic.
That was Hannu Hallinen, Finland's ambassador to the Arctic, on China's role in the region. Monocle's transport editor, Tristan McAllister, joins us now. Tristan, welcome to Aperitivo.
Thanks for having me.
I should say chin chin. Then it was the appropriate time to really say
I don't have
say
a glass
that.
To hold up, but maybe later.
That's all right. There's one turned upside down in front of you. The Northwest Passage is obviously something that's, well, it's been growing importance for ages. I've got an image in my mind of these Russian nuclear submarines ploughing through it, smashing up the ice. These are images that sort of seem kind of like a spy movie somehow. What's the importance of all this to the players involved?
Well, think about the shift, Rob. This could be monumental if it does in fact go the way that a lot of the Arctic region of the world is saying that it will. When we think about choke points for shipping, we think traditionally of Singapore, of Panama, of the Suez Canal. But now there's this, a naturally formed or forming, be it by climate change, whatever else, passage to Europe from Asia that is significantly shorter than conventional routes. And it's a massive shift, and it could mean a huge change in the way things are done in places like Singapore and Panama. So and it could shift and change communities in Arctic regions.
And we said in the introduction there, something that I didn't know, that Putin's opened up a Soviet-era military base. I should open this up to all three of our guests here. Is this a sort of saber-rattling maneuver? Is this a practical maneuver? It might just turn into a port.
Of course, it's not the first time that Russia's increased its presence in the Arctic. There was a time a few years ago when they sent a submarine down to the
There's a flag on the
seabed,
ocean floor,
put
there?
A little metal flag on the ocean floor. And then they rather backed off and said, no, we want to be very peaceful and there's no sort of real geopolitical conflict here. And I think what they're doing is also spotting the differences within Western countries. You've got the Canadians and the Americans not getting on terribly well on this. There's been a Russian charm offensive with the Norwegians, trying very hard to get the Norwegians to see things Russia. Excuse me.
Bless you.
That wasn't a Russian cough. That was Michael.
I think that's Edward's criticism of the wine.
Yes, the wine is memorable and distinctive, very distinctive. But you're absolutely right. Both China and indeed South Korea wanting to become part of the Arctic Council, and I think that everyone else has disarmed rather in the Arctic. We don't have And the Canadians basically wound down their navy at the end of the Cold War. America's now hurriedly trying to rebuild its Arctic fleet, but the Russians are there. And they've got a lot of experience in the Arctic. They've got nuclear icebreakers, and this, what they call the Northern Route, what we call the Northeastern Passage, is going to become very important, and they've got their thumbs on it.
Tristan, I wanted to say, what sort of hardware are people putting into this? Are the players involved putting into this?
That's a really interesting question. You know, of course, we did speak to the Finnish ambassador to the Arctic earlier today, and in a conversation I had with him, he expressed a conversation that he had with the Coast Guard generals in the state of Alaska. What's so interesting up there is infrastructurally, in terms of how they could monitor a shifting sort of sea lane, in terms of how they could actually enforce things in the Arctic, it would be a huge challenge for them. Of course, there are military bases in the state of Alaska, but what the Coast Guard does on a regular basis in terms of patrols, they have three helicopters that cover a significant portion of ocean up there. So in terms of hardware, I think the scramble is on. It's not necessarily a military buildup, but it's just this idea of getting things on the ground and making sure that if something does go wrong, or if something were to happen, or if enforcement does need to start happening, that they have the vehicles to do that.
And of course, it's not just the transport route. There's oil, and there's gas, and there's fish. So there's three scarce natural resources all up there, plus possibly other forms of seabed mining.
Right, of course, and that's part and parcel to the economy. It has been in Alaska for a very, very long time.
So we could potentially see, and briefly, because we're going to scramble our choppers down to Central Asia in a minute. But it could potentially be an old school gold rush kind of situation.
But I mean, I was just going to say, you know, as with so many of these sorts of discussions, when we talk about the sort of the trade routes that are opening up and sort of new areas that are opening while others are sort of fighting over the security component, I mean, it's a Chinese ship that left from, I think, Dalian the other day last week to try to get through this route to get to Europe, to end up in Rotterdam. So, you know, while everyone else is scrambling around trying to figure out how we're going to defend this, how we're going to do this, you know, the Chinese COSCO, the big, you know, shipping magnate there, is actually sending a boat to see what's viable and what's not, to try to figure out, you know, how you can actually make money out of this. So it's a sort of traditional role that the Chinese have increasingly been playing in all these international affairs, where, you know, others can do all this and we'll just do the economics to actually make money out of the situation.
Okay, we're going to move down to Central Asia before we hit the headlines at the bottom of the hour. Raf, I wanted to ask you about that. What particular resources are there, and who's squabbling over them?
Well, I mean, it's funny because, of course, a lot of the resources and a lot of the discussions that we were just having about the sort of Northeastern Passage are very same thing. You know, Central Asia is rich in natural resources and hydrocarbons in particular. President Xi Jinping was just in Central Asia doing a big tour of the region. He signed the big deal. CNPC have finally bought into the mammoth Kashagan field in Kazakhstan. In Turkmenistan, he presided over the opening of another pipeline from Turkmenistan to China. You know, so the whole area is being entirely rerouted, rewired in many ways, and sort of the physical infrastructure, be it through natural resource exploitation, be it through, you know, roads and highways and trains, all to head towards China. You know, and when we're talking about routes through there as well, there was another story I heard the other day where there's now a Chinese, you can get trains. So HP in particular, I heard, was sending goods. I think the New York Times had a very good piece about this, which was sending goods overland by train from China all the way to Europe. And that route takes, apparently on a good trip, it takes about 18 or 19 days, which is, you know, very fast from China, the producer, to Europe, the consumer. The COSCO vessel that's trying to go up the north through this sort of Northeastern Passage, that's going to take, I think, about 30 days or so.
Well, and there are high-speed rail ambitions that'll take it to a week.
Exactly.
I think it's astonishing. Yeah. And if you look back 10 years, Central Asia seemed completely under Russia's thumb. Mm. If anyone said 10 years ago that the Turkmen, who sit on one of the world's biggest gas reserves, would build a pipeline all the way to China, people have said, what are you smoking? And
now they're building five.
Drinking a monocle wine.
It's absolutely astonishing the way the Russians have managed to screw up, technical term, but true, their relations with Central Asia. They blew up the Turkmen pipeline at one point to try and scare the Turkmen. The Turkmen responded by redoubling their efforts to sell to China. And I think Russia's basically losing Central Asia now, which it really was Russia's backyard. This is something they conquered back in the 19th century with enormous difficulty, and now they're basically losing it to China. And although on paper, these countries, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, are tied in with Russia in various customs unions and other sort of security treaties, the common factor is they all hate Moscow.
It's fascinating stuff. And I feel a cold war of resource mongering descending upon us. Before we go,
can I plug my book, The New Cold War, which is exactly about this.
Could you see that coming? Let's do that.
Thank you.
Before we head to the news, I wanted to ask you, Tristan, to get people's sort of transport nerd juices flowing. What, again, what sort of things are on the rails? What's on the roads? I mean, you know, are new things being developed in order to handle all this kind of heavy goods?
Well, one of the things we talk about a lot, or at least I'm closely watching, is this massive development in Southeast Asia in terms of infrastructure, in terms of creating a sort of a start point for a high-speed rail network that goes all the way through onto Europe. The Thais have extreme ambition in terms of getting goods, fresh goods, flowers, for instance, from Thailand to Europe through Central Asia on trains. And so that's a monumental task in terms of infrastructure, but they say it can be done, and where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, look at what the Thai have done in terms of building airports and just doing things fast. They do things far faster than the Western world, so it's coming.
If the Chinese can build a railway to Tibet, I think they can build one through Central Asia. The problem comes when it hits Russia, where things slow down a bit.
Right. And of course, the Thai are working closely, or us presumed to be working closely with the Chinese at some point to make all of this happen.
Well, it sounds like this show. It just looks like it runs on rails. Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport correspondent. Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist and author of The New Cold War. And fierce critic of Monocle's wines. We'll chill down in Mombasiak for you next time. And Raf Pantucci, senior research fellow at RUSI. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House to unpack some of our big stories this week. Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be back in a second with the news headlines.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And before we start part two of this second edition of Aperitivo at 1831 here in London, Paul Osborne has the news headlines.
A UN report says North Korea has carried out a series of unspeakable atrocities against its own citizens. Investigators say they've uncovered widespread abuses of human rights after speaking to former prisoners and people who've been exiled by the regime. North Korean officials have dismissed the allegations. They'd refused to cooperate with the report. The Russian foreign minister has said he's still not convinced that the Syrian regime was behind last month's chemical attack in Damascus. Sergei Lavrov was speaking after talks with his French counterpart Laurent Fabius in Moscow. But Mr. Fabius said the publication of a UN report which highlighted the use of sarin gas left no doubt President Assad's forces were responsible. The Supreme Court in Bangladesh has sentenced an Islamist leader to death for crimes dating back more than 40 years. Abdul Qadir Mullah was originally jailed for life earlier this year over the violence in the War of Independence with Pakistan in 1971. But after street protests, the country's highest court has now said he should be executed. An armed standoff is continuing in a ski resort in Austria after three police officers and an emergency paramedic were shot dead. It happened near the town of Annaberg when officers tried to arrest a suspected poacher who has now barricaded himself in a farmhouse. And an art dealer in New York has admitted a 15-year fraud worth millions of dollars. Clefira Rizal has admitted defrauding two galleries in Manhattan by selling them more than 60 fake works. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne, with a bulletin that did not contain any clowns. But a nice bit of art fraud.
Bit of art fraud. I thought that was a nice juxtaposition. Scary clowns half an hour ago and an entirely convincing art fraudster.
I like that. I like that. I want to know whether he had sort of paint on his... whether he was a dealer or an artist himself, whether he had sort of a berry and paint on his...
I don't mean to disparage one of the greatest artists of many years gone by, but one of the artists there were fakes knocked up of was Mark Rothko. And while Rothko's works are genius, I'm suggesting that a less inspired person could knock out a Rothko.
Yeah. It's easier than Van Gogh, right?
It's a little bit easier.
Easier than a Bruegel.
If you don't have an eye for an eye for a line.
Paul Osborne is as harsh a critic of modern art than Edward Lucas from The Economist magazine is of wine.
All right. I'd say I'm a friendly supporter.
We're going to head down now. It's 1834 in London, by the way. It's 2134 in Moscow, and that makes it half past lunchtime in Rio de Janeiro. Each day on Aperitivo, we'll be leaving the comfortable confines of Studio One here at Midori House. I say comfortable confines, it's basically freezing in here. We'll be heading down to the equally well-appointed Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street. On today's show, as Fashion Week here in London winds down, Monocle's David Pleasant is waiting at the cafe right now with Gwyn Miles, director of the Somerset House Trust.
Thanks, Rob. And I'm joined here by Gwyn Miles, the director of the Somerset House Trust. Thank you for joining us, Gwyn. If I can start, can we just discuss the importance of Somerset House for people who might not be familiar with it, although I find that hard to imagine. If anyone's been to London, they will have come across Somerset House. It is that important. Where did it all start? It despite appearances, it's not as old or traditional an institution as one might imagine. Where did you get going on it?
Well, the point about Somerset House is it is an absolutely fabulous building right smack in the middle of London. So it's on the north bank of the Thames in a very central position. And it was a royal palace, but that was swept away in the 18th century. And it was built actually as government offices. And so this very beautiful building actually hides one of the first office blocks in London. And at the end of the 20th century, people started to campaign to open these sort of buildings up. We had a car park in the middle, a civil service car park, and there was a lot of feeling that these things should be opened up to the public. So we were set up right at the end of the 20th century as a trust to preserve the buildings, to open them, parts of them, to the public, and to run an arts and cultural centre. And we only opened to the public in the year 2000. When we did that, we only had a small part of the building. A lot of it was still the Inland Revenue. And what's happened over the last few years is the Inland Revenue have retreated, and we now have the whole space ourselves to play with. So it's great.
Great. And I should just apologise to listeners for the background noise. There seems to be some building works happening at a former fire station across Chilton Street there.
Thank you. That's lovely.
Our coffee's just arrived. And if we look forward, Somerset House is hosting, it's just the latest of the exhibitions that it hosts, a fascinating show coming up, again to do with fashion, the Isabel Blow Fashion Galore exhibition, which opens in a few months. Isabel Blow, an icon of British fashion, but perhaps a little bit kind of overlooked, or maybe some people might not know so much about her. She was a figure that was iconic within the fashion circles. Give us a little bit of background. What's the significance of this show?
Isabella Blow was fantastically influential during her lifetime, which was unfortunately short, but she was somebody who really was extremely good at picking up on talent. So she was the person who bought Alexander McQueen's first show, and she was always actually herself embodying the fashion that she bought. So she would wear extraordinary things, she would behave in a way that everybody thought was wonderful. She was greatly loved, and she worked with a lot of designers to produce, you know, what are now, as you say, iconic images of fashion from the 80s through the 90s and now. When her wardrobe came up for sale, Daphne Guinness bought it, and it was always very much in their mind that they wanted to show this extremely important collection. And luckily, our assistant curator had actually been the person who catalogued the archive, so she knew the collection very well. So with Central St Martin's and the Daphne Guinness Foundation, we're putting together what I think will be an absolutely beautiful show, which will show how important Isabella was to fashion as a patron and as somebody who could talk about what she was doing in a way that nobody else did. So I think she's a very important figure, and it will be a very magical show.
So we're just going to move into the nice couch area here at the back of the cafe. And just talking about the kind of shows that you put on at Somerset House, I always get the feeling that there's this kind of, you're not trying to attract kind of everybody. It's a curated experience, but it's got that kind of surprise element. You walk into this courtyard and suddenly there's a show, you know, about Isabella Blow, about another figure from the fashion world. What's the kind of if you're at the meeting on the drawing board, as it were, kind of figuring out what the program is for the years ahead. What are those meetings like? What are the discussions?
Well, we try to get things that are different, but we're also looking at contemporary culture, particularly fashion, photography, architecture, and now even food. So we like to do things that other people aren't doing. So we're not looking for blockbuster art shows. There are plenty of people doing those really well. But we think we can put a little spotlight onto something people haven't seen before. So we did an exhibition of Valentino, but we will also do an exhibition of Erwin Blumenfeld, who was a fantastic photographer. And in the next month, we're going to have an RIBA exhibition about forgotten spaces, which are architects envisioning what they could do inside old tube stations and all over the place. And that'll be great. And that'll be in the dead house underneath the courtyard. So there are lots of spaces in Somerset House we can use in surprising ways. And I suppose what we try and do, things that we think will be appealing, but also surprising, and that you can just get something to talk about and then come and have a drink overlooking the River Thames on our river terrace.
Quinn, thank you very much. Very tempting. I might stroll down there this evening if it's not too chilly. Thank you, and back to you, Rob.
Thank you, David. That was David Pleasant with Gwyn Miles, director of the Somerset House Trust. Also, they're interviewing a drill who was just a drill. Stay tuned to find out more of this episode of The Aperitivo. It's on Monocle 24. It's 18:40 here in London. Stay tuned.
The Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all, and on it lives.
That man was right. It is the Aperitivo, and I'm Robert Bounds. The market for organic products has boomed recently, and in many Western markets, everything organic has become big business. But in other places, organic products are often seen as luxury items and are often unaffordable. In Turkey, the small but growing market for organic goods demonstrates how particularly important market phenomenon, namely perception and awareness, affect both supply and demand, and help explain why the organic sector in Turkey remains a field of opportunity and challenge.
I'm eating a peach from Şabanlı.
He tells me not to rush with my questions, and we can talk after I finish my peach. And then as soon as I do, he hands me half of a fresh fig. He stuck three almonds into it.
Aklına ne geliyorsa hepsinden var. Bizde 80 çeşit ürün var. Yazlık.
Whatever you can think of, we produce, Şabanlı tells me. Apart from the peaches and the figs and almonds, on his 250 square kilometer organic farm, Şaban Bey grows 80 different fruits and vegetables. This is the organic market, or ekolojik pazar, in Feriköy, Istanbul. It is the oldest and biggest organic products market in Turkey, in operation since 2006. There are lots of people here, but it's not crowded. About 100 sellers are selling honey, olive oil, fruits, vegetables, soaps, and full sunflower heads. The marketplace is actually a covered parking lot. Green girders and beams support a roof, on the other side of which is another car park and a fenced-in football pitch where some kids are doing their Saturday morning drills. And because this is the center of Istanbul, the market is surrounded by the sounds of the city. I was actually surprised to hear that demand for organic products has not taken off in Turkey. Turkish cuisine is built primarily of things that you can do with fresh vegetables, and it's easy to hear people complaining about meat and produce that is hormonlu, that is literally with hormones, a word that defines the whole gambit of engineered food here. Also, most families in Istanbul migrated here from somewhere else in Turkey, and still, even after generations, refer to the provincial cities and villages of their forebears as their real hometowns, places most associate with a more natural way of life.
This marketplace project is a model. This is the first in Turkey, and this kind of I didn't hear in India, in Europe, in Canada, because they're all local. This marketplace, organic marketplace project is national.
Batur Şehirlioğlu is co-general manager of the Buday Ecological Living Support Association. Buday means wheat in Turkish. Batur coordinates the organic markets in Istanbul. What they've done to help grow the organic market in Turkey is to modify the local farmers market concept and draw in produce from across the country.
Zonguldak Alaplı,
İzmir, Isparta,
Bursa Karacabey Kıranlarköy,
Bodrum.
Those were just a few of the cities that producers at Istanbul's fair came from. None are particularly close to Istanbul.
The first one is Şişli. It's 2006 we established, shall we say.
And that's where we are right now.
Yes, yes. And in Istanbul there are three others: Kartal, Beylikdüzü, and Bakırköy. And we will hopefully in this year open two more.
Though Batur and his associates have established markets elsewhere in Turkey and are trying to encourage local markets as well, there are important reasons that the main market is Istanbul. Serpil Baydar is the Istanbul representative of City Farm, Turkey's biggest packager of organic products. She says there's a big difference between natural and organic, and not everybody realizes this. It's a common misperception that natural production is somehow the same as organic production.
Even the small farms use lots of chemistry, pesticides, so it's the production is not clean there.
Doğan Çetinkaya teaches political science at Istanbul University and is a regular customer at the market. He sees some evidence of changing perceptions.
So even in the countryside, in the small towns, the villages, they also started to complain about their own production.
But still, organic farming in the modern sense remains a foreign idea in Turkey. Batur Şehirlioğlu of Buday explains.
The problem is in Turkey, organic production starts because of the ithalat.
Export.
Export, yeah. They want to export from Turkey. There is not production, there is not too much production for the inner market. More than 90-95% we are exporting it. Because the idea in Europe or South America, it comes from the consumers and the producers. But in Turkey, it comes where? From the Europe.
But why is demand in Turkey so low?
The problem is the prices. For example, I hear that in Europe, conventional and organic, when you compare, is 20%, yeah, 20% more or 50% more, not more. But in Turkey, the consumption is less, awareness is less. The logistic problems is more because consuming mostly in Istanbul, producing in all over Turkey. Our benzin, mazot is the top in all
prices.
The world.
Petrol,
gas prices.
Petrol prices.
Consumption must raise, the prices must get low.
What, you were mentioning that in Europe it's 20% or 50% more than conventional. What is the rate here?
It depends on the season. Mm. Sometimes same price, but mostly 50%, sometimes twice.
Most sellers I spoke with agreed that making money in the local market was hard, but there were some exceptions. Ferdun Inanli, an olive oil producer, said small-scale production, especially of olive oil, was an advantage. Olive trees respond better in organic conditions, and producing small quantities makes it easier to clear one's stock each season and stay profitable. Though demand for organic products may go up if prices come down, the key, most sellers said, was that awareness has to be increased. And selling organic goods in major retail chains is not the way to raise awareness.
If you put first there or in small shops, we cannot raise awareness. But marketplaces are public places.
Bizim bölgemizdeki tüketici o konuda bilinçli değildi.
After I finished my peach and almond stuffed fig, Şaban Bey explains his view of the awareness issue. Outside of Istanbul, awareness is very low, which is another reason he says the city is the main market. The basics are known, Şaban says, that it's healthy and good for the environment, but people aren't aware of the important relationships like how the amount of public and private money spent on healthcare and treating the sick dwarfs the amount that would be required to get a much better preventative healthcare return through investing, again publicly and privately, in healthy organic food. Millions of peaches, peaches for me. And despite different motivations for getting into the organic business, everyone I spoke with mentioned in one way or another that idealism or moral principle was as much a part of their business plan as looking after the bottom line. Apart from being a nice and friendly place to buy wonderful food, the Buday Organic Market in Istanbul is a fascinating place to see the relationship between new and old economics. For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Caleb Lauer.
That was Caleb Lauer. He sounds like he needs some strepsils or to gargle with some salt water. I like his voice, I'm just saying. You are tuned in to Aperitivo. It's 1849 here in London. I'm Robert Bounds. I want to play you a new piece of music. I interviewed Kate Le Bon for the November issue of the magazine, the Welsh singer-songwriter. She's just released this track, Are You With Me Now, on SoundCloud. It's great. It's from the museum, the album called My Mug Museum, which is out in November. Check this out. It's Are You With Me Now. Are You With Me Now? Upcoming from Kate Le Bon. It's on SoundCloud. The album is out in November. That's called Mug Museum. I'm listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the show. But before we go, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by the producer of this evening's Globalist Asia, Tom Lewis, and Marcus Hippie, who's presenting tonight's Daily. Chaps, welcome.
Good evening, Rob. How are you, Rob?
Welcome. I'm all right. When I signed up to do a show called Aperitivo, I thought there'd be a bit more booze involved. I thought there was going to be a bit more Aperol, a bit more of the Glenlivet itself. And less Syria, but
well,
there you go.
But you know, things can change, can't they? This is just the start of the journey.
It's the start of the journey, it's the end of the show, so we can all kind of tuck in now. I saw you, Tom, during that song, waving a bit of a flag with a dragon on it.
I was quite happy with that. Nice to see a fellow Welsh person doing well, making great things, and such a lovely voice, Rob.
Exactly, and we were saying we shouldn't be anything without that Welsh.
No, absolutely, exactly. I mean, the old myth is that every single Welsh person can sing, but I mean, if you ever stand outside my shower of a morning, you'll see that's not true.
Let's not put ourselves in that position.
ever since Thomas joined the team, I felt like there is some kind of a competition going on between Finland and Wales. Therefore,
bring it, Marcus. Bring it.
Actually, I have to say I like the song as well.
We'll have a Finnish song tomorrow.
Crunchy autumnal number with a bit of Sandy Denny in there and a bit of Karen Dalton in there. Very lovely thing. Anyway, we're going to have to settle this Finland versus Wales match. Not on the pitch, but on the airwaves. Marcus, go first. What have you got? You're presenting The Daily tonight. What's happening in that show?
I am presenting today's edition of The Monocle Daily together with Andrew Miller. We start the show by looking at the relations between Brazil and the US. Obviously, there's been a lot of Brazilians furious about the recent reports when it comes to spying on the communications in Brazil, including actually communications of the country's president by the US. We are looking at what is going to be happening now once the US has sent a new ambassador to the country, a career diplomat who's got decades of work in a neighbouring country behind him. He's actually flown into Brasilia yesterday and is going to have quite a lot of work.
He's got a lot of hands to shake. I should imagine he's going to do a sort of presidential baby kissing parade there. I think he needs to make some buddies.
The PR needs to be quite significant.
It does.
It is very interesting. He landed at the airport. Obviously, there were a lot of journalists waiting for him already and asking questions. And the only questions he basically didn't want to answer were about what's been going on regarding spying. So I think he still needs to think of what to say to those people. He's going to need to answer those questions sooner or later, definitely.
And the White House confirmed a little bit earlier today that Dilma Rousseff would not be visiting the US now either, so it's quite a rolling story, Marcus.
Quite cold times when it comes to relations between those two countries. Another story from Italy. We are going to be talking about the rise of anti-gay sentiment in Italy. Quite startling numbers, actually, coming from there. And we're going to be looking at the reasons for it. Is it the ever-worsening financial situation in the country, or what? And basically, what could change the situation?
That's an interesting barometer of looking at social or economic woes about the social, that sort of side of the social thing. How are you guys covering that story, for example?
We're going to be talking to our correspondent from Italy, for example, and we're getting the views from there. So that is definitely something. It's actually quite interesting when you think of the countries with the rise of anti-gay sentiment, how they're doing financially. It seems like there is always some kind of connection between how well the country is doing and what the tolerance level there is.
Well, that's the Monocle Daily. What time? Tell our listening several what time that is on, Marcus, and they can hear your mellifluous Finnish tones again.
That is at 2200 hours London time, which equals to 6 a.m. in Tokyo and 1400 hours in San Francisco.
He wasn't even looking at the clock when he did Thomas.
No,
can you do that?
Right. No, I cannot.
Come on, Team
Hands
Wales.
Down. Okay.
Where are we going? The Globalist Asia. What's
so
on that
So it's 8 p.m.
tonight?
London time, and therefore 3 p.m. Eastern time. Am I correct?
I stumbled the first hurdle.
So we're going to be in Malaysia, and with the death of Chin Peng, the former head of the Malaysia Communist Party, very divisive figure, and has lived in exile for decades. Now, his final wish was that his remains, when he died, would be buried in Malaysia on Malaysian soil. Now, the Prime Minister of Malaysia came out yesterday and said categorically that would never happen. Now, before he died, it's quite an intriguing story. He said that he would get his remains into Malaysia with the help of four of his assistants secretly if he needed to. That is kind of a story of intrigue that obviously no one really knows the details of. But it's quite interesting. We'll be looking at how a country who has kind of quite a dark chapter in its history reconciles the present and the past. Obviously, this will kind of conjure and is already conjuring kind of many emotions among former supporters, if there are any left, but also people who want to make sure the communist past, as grim as it was, is still recognised in modern Malaysia.
I like the sound of that, Tom. That sounds like a decent edition of The Globalist Asia with a bit of an existential edge to it.
Indeed.
Chaps, thank you. Have great shows a little later on. That's all we have time for on this edition of Aperitivo. It's brand new edition two, this was. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Edward Lucas and Raffaello Pantucci. We talked through Putin's Syria brinkmanship. Here's a bit of what Edward Lucas, international editor of The Economist, had to say on that.
It's astonishing to me that Russia has got the kind of chutzpah to portray itself as a peacemaker. It's like some sort of little boy who murders his parents with an axe and then tells the court to take mercy on him because he's an orphan. It's even more amazing that the world will take it seriously.
Hard talk indeed. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firmenich and Ilya Simos, and our studio manager was Bill Luty. Next up, it's Section D. Then at 2000 hours London time, we'll have The Globalist Asia. 2200 Monocle Daily airs. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. Thanks for tuning in.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.